This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Shall we begin?
Expecto Patronum!
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Hello, everyone. Happy Valentine's Day Eve here on Popcorn Culture. I am Lee Treelin, and in the studio with me today, as always, we have Arvind Yuvaraj and Shamila Ganesan. And yes, because it is soon to be a day that some regard as a cynical money grab, others regard as a time to celebrate love and romance. We thought we'd do a bit of both, actually.
And, no money grab. I don't think anyone's sending us money.
No, not money grab. What is this? Just opportunistic.
Yeah,
capitalizing.
Thing, pretty much. Mm-hmm. So we are going to be talking today about romance, about romance in films. And we heard there, I suppose, a classic example, a classic couple whose status would have been it's complicated for, mm-hmm. for quite a bit. And so maybe let's begin then by discussing what is romantic to us when it comes to the movies. What do we consider romance?
You know, the what we just heard, the Gone with the Wind, the classic sort of grand love story on screen, I don't think that's something that ever appealed to me as a, you know, my very early idea of romance is actually something more like The Sound of Music, where the love is a lot more day-to-day. It's more prosaic. I don't think you can call Sound of Music prosaic, but it's almost incidental to the other things that are happening in the story. And I don't know whether because of that, I've always gravitated towards the love stories that are much more down-to-earth, that are set in what could be more our lives than someone living 200 years ago wearing puffy dresses.
Right.
Like a period piece kind of thing?
Yeah. I mean, period romance can be really fun. And just really involving. I'm thinking of something like Pride and Prejudice, for instance, but I feel like I feel those more when I read them. Somehow when I watch them on screen, I enjoy them as a story. I don't necessarily enjoy the romance aspect of it as much.
So for me, romantic films have to have friendships in them. Like there has to be a sense of like a deep-rooted friendship between two people who are on two separate journeys as individuals, but for some reason they are getting to that destination on the same road, if that makes sense. They don't have to get there together, but being on this journey together makes it infinitely better for the both of them. So it's the when I see movies like rom-coms and like your classic Hollywood romantic story where, you know, it's the guy trying to get the girl or the girl trying to get the guy, I understand what they're going through, but I don't relate to it. And I don't think it's romantic because their destination is each other. Mm-hmm. Like they have to complete each other in a way, and that becomes the goal of the movie. So I don't get that. It has to be, they both want to get to a certain thing and they don't need each other to do it, but they'd like the other to be there with them. If that makes sense. I don't know if I'm saying it correctly.
It makes sense. I think it's kind of what we should want in life.
Yeah. No, I think...
And I'm like, oh, you've already gone there. I'm already like gooey and mushy inside.
Yeah,
it's too early for this.
Very, very sweet sentiment. Yeah. I think that... So I've just been thinking about how often I go to the cinema for a love story. How often I actually pay money and head out to a movie theater. And I don't think that it actually happens that often. And I'm not sure why. I don't know if it's because we are now primarily used to sort of tentpole cinema. We only go to the theater if it's worth seeing on a big screen, whatever that means to you. And I think more often than not, love stories don't fall into that category, right? Because they're quiet dramas. They tend to involve, it's more really about the people who have been cast than it is about any effects that you're going to see. And so for that reason, yeah, I don't know actually what I want from a love story on screen. I think I just want to feel a lot of feelings. Mm. But at the same time, even as I'm saying that, I'm like, maybe this isn't my favorite genre of film. Mm. I don't know. I don't think movies that centralize love stories necessarily appeal to me all that much outside of rom-coms, which I had a complete weakness for, you know, for the longest time. They don't make them both as much or as well anymore. But I think in their heyday, in the time of like your Meg Ryans and your Julia Roberts, I was all about a good rom-com. Mm.
It's interesting that you say genre, because some of my favorite romantic films are from a different genre. So they happen to be like either sci-fi or adventure films or comedies. A lot of them are actually comedies that have like romance as a byproduct. So two people who are in love or trying to be with each other or something. And so that becomes like the platform for their relationship. But mostly the movie is comedic in nature. It's not made to be a romantic movie. But those are some of my like favorite, you know, quote-unquote lovey-dovey films.
So it's interesting what you said, Lynn, about big feelings, right? About having this associating the idea of love stories with feelings. Because, yeah, that's what I meant, I think, in a way, when I said I'm not necessarily drawn to movies like that. I do remember, though, that as a kid, I don't think as a teenager, I wasn't yet a teenager, I was obsessed with Love Story, which starred, came out in 1970, and I wasn't born in 1970, but I watched it much later, and it's Ally McGraw and Ryan O'Neal, yeah. And it's basically a couple that falls in love, and then, you know, one of them gets sick.
Wrong side of the tracks, though. Yeah. Don't forget that part of the story.
So it has
as well.
All of those elements, and it's essentially a grand tragedy, and that I realize is a thread that holds together a lot of what we think of as love stories, that they're often very tragic and they're really sad. Because I'm thinking of something like West Side Story, which is another story that I associate with like being in love. Again, fairly sad and ultimately doomed, and which is and I'm like, is that all we have? The rom-coms and then the tragedies?
I think sometimes what we also have are movies that use a love story as the impetus for everything else to happen. Mm-hmm. And actually, this came to me just as you were talking about Love Story, as in capital L, capital S, Love Story. And it's Up, which is a movie that has a romance at its heart, right? Like, it is a romance that is represented in the house that actually he's so desperately trying to get, you know, to the falls. And I have never, ever met a person who could watch the opening sequence of Up and not shed a tear. Yes. I've never met that person.
Or like in my case, just weep. Like for the whole thing.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I didn't know we were going to do this PTSD thing now. But yeah, this caught me like off guard. I'm like, oh, Up, no.
Yeah, no, but you know what I mean, right? And Up is at its very heart a love story and about learning to love again. Mm, but it's not one that you're going to find on any list of greatest love stories or anything, because it's ostensibly about an old man and a kid. But really, it's also about Carl and Ellie.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that you brought that up. And I was thinking about this earlier when you mentioned sci-fi, because I was just thinking about what the most recent iteration of love on screen that really got to me was. Weirdly enough, it's actually it was actually Avengers Endgame. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm aware people may not have watched it, so I will not give it away. But Captain America's story, how it eventually sort of came to an end, and the romance aspect of it, if you've seen it, you'll know what I mean. Mm-hmm. That really got to me more than I think most movies that are supposed to be about love stories. This really got to me. So again, I don't think that love story has, or in like in the case of Up, a story doesn't have to have love at its center to affect people.
Yeah, and it happens like, and it's normally these movies that serve like a massive gut punch, but a gut punch in a good way, like a gut punch that's made out of cookies and brownies and stuff. But because you don't see it coming, you're watching the movie for something else entirely. You're watching it for, you know, supervillains who want to destroy the universe. And then it has love in as a huge plot. Mm-hmm. And it gives you that plot sort of like unprepared, like without warning. And I think those movies sort of work the romantic angle best or in the best way, kind of.
Okay, we're going to be continuing this conversation and we're going to come around to this idea of modern romance and how it's displayed on screen. But of course, we'd love to hear from you as well. What are some of your favorite romantic movies? They don't necessarily have to be grand romances, as we've displayed here with Avengers Endgame and Up entering the fray. You know, it doesn't all have to be Titanic, although if you missed our throwback, you can also catch that.
Yes.
Anyway, tell us what your favorite romantic films are. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. You can tweet us at BFM Radio and, of course, call us at 7732900. You're listening to Popcorn Culture, BFM 89.9.
Best flipping moments. BFM 89.9, the business station.
If I hadn't been Fox Books and you hadn't been the shop around the corner and you and I had just met.
I know.
Yeah. I would have asked for your number. And I wouldn't have been able to wait 24 hours before calling you up and saying, hey, how about some coffee or, you know, drinks or dinner or a movie? For as long as we both shall live.
Joe?
And you and I would never have been at war. And the only thing we'd fight about would be which video to run on a Saturday night.
Who fights about that?
Well, some people. Not us.
We would never.
Hello, everyone. You are listening to Popcorn Culture with Lynn, Arvin, and Sharmila. And in light of it being the eve of Valentine's Day, we thought we would spend our hour on this supercut talking to you about romance in films. And you just heard there, of course, a snippet of You've
Tom
Got Mail.
Hanks.
Mm. One of the mushiest snippets ever made.
Yes. That's, of course, Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan, who for a time, they've made three films together, but Meg Ryan herself for a time could not put a foot wrong when it came to making romantic comedies and romantic films in general. And that's what we wanted to spend this bit of the show talking about, namely, what makes a good romantic lead? So I suppose if we use Meg Ryan as exhibit number one, I think a lot of it had to do with that some innate sense of relatability, right? Like you should feel that you've met this person.
Girl next door.
Yeah.
Everyone, like at least from a male perspective and a female perspective, I would feel like the men want to look at her as somebody whom they could ostensibly date and not feel like she was too far out of their reach. And the women wanted to both be her and to like her and not someone that they viewed as a threat, which I think are both... I mean, you can unpack that how you will, right? Gender differences being what they are. But I think that is kind of that trope that you look for when you look at these fairly heteronormative romantic comedies.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's stood many of them in really good stead for a really long time.
Which is also why I think a lot of people like the normal-looking, quote-unquote normal-looking people for Hollywood standards more than the George Clooney's or
a Tom Hanks.
Like a Tom Hanks. Yeah. Like a Tom Hanks. I think Tom Hanks got his role because of people like Billy Crystal. And then you have the quirkier ones that came out after that. Steve Carell, you had Seth Rogen, I think, is a good romantic lead. Even in all his goofiness and highness, he's a good romantic lead. You know, people like that, Joseph Gordon-Levitt is a good romantic lead, because I think you have to justify to the audience why they would want to be with this person, or they should understand why the significant other would want to spend their life or like a significant amount of time with this person. Otherwise, if they're so inaccessible, you don't get it.
You get a tragedy.
Then you get a tragedy, and you cannot explain to yourself why they would go through all this drama just to be with this other person.
So I think this is related in some ways to our recent conversation about whether or not movie stars are still a thing, because there was a time, of course, where, like we said, we heard Clark Gable and Vivian Leigh right at the top of the show. And there was a time where we expected our stars to be inaccessible. That was the whole point, you know. You are supposed to be better than me. Mm. You are supposed to not look like anybody that I could just walk down the street and see. And the same thing was expressed in romance films. So there was a certain type of male star who knew how to swashbuckle and who knew how to grab a woman. And there was also the type of female star who would know how to swoon, who would know how to who to angle it just right.
And the single tear while still looking like she sparkles.
Exactly. And so I wonder when it was that we started to really move away from that. And I would say that the break happened, I think, sometime in the 60s, perhaps, which was also when we started to see more realistic, grimy depictions of things on film. Because if I think of something like West Side Story, it's still a very stylized, sparkly version of the world.
I mean, if you look at some, Roman Holiday tries to sell you Gregory Peck as a nerdy journalist type.
For God's sake.
So it's still, they still hadn't really, I think it really took some time to get to that. As we started getting more comedians like Billy Crystal playing male leads, as they started having this divide between with women entering the workforce and not necessarily needing to be all of that perfection that you expect, you know, Stepford Wife style at home or whatever. I feel like that's when that change happened, because it's really post-70s and like the early 80s that you start seeing this, the romantic comedy in particular, coming out. And that brought out a particular kind of lead, your Tom Hanks and your Meg Ryan, Julia Roberts later, who all are not your stereotypical cookie cutter leading actors.
See, I always thought it happened for the male leads. And I always thought that happened because of the male-dominated box office. So you have these, and I don't mean this as like an offense, but these schlubby-looking guys as the lead, because they are more accessible and more relatable to the common guy. You put someone with like an 8-pack on screen, and immediately there's like a divide. So how many people are in the cinema who, you know, have that 8-pack? The women, however, I don't think have changed. Like, Julia Roberts is not accessible.
You're right. Julia Roberts is not your average woman.
No, or even a Meg Ryan or any of the leads that came out in the 90s, I don't think any of them looked like accessible human beings. Like basically they were Hollywoodized. So that's also like an interesting, you know, look on things. Like Tom Hanks, in any other world, Tom Hanks going after any of the people he was in these like romantic films would be like, she's out of your league.
But it also boils down to what women look for in romance versus what men look for, right? Because when I think of Sleepless in Seattle, which I love, I watched it as a kid, I've rewatched it as a teenager, I've watched it as an adult, I still continuously love it. It's not because he's good looking that you love him.
It's because he's sad.
It's because he's sad. It's because he's kind. Yeah. It's because he's a good father. It's because he's funny in this weird deadpan way.
And charming.
Yeah. So I don't think women are as necessarily driven by looks. I don't know. I don't know whether I'm being stereotyped here, but we're taught to look for other things.
Well, I'm not sure. Yeah, I mean, I can see where you're coming from, but I also think that when it comes to romantic comedies, because they are templatized, and I don't say that in a bad way, they just are, people who enjoy them for that very reason. I think because of that, a certain level of charm and funniness is needed and expected, and also writers write to account for that.
Of course.
So they write to display otherwise, sure, schlubby-looking characters in their best light. I mean, while looking for clips for our show today, I was, you know, kind of running through the different segments of You've Got Mail, and there's a section where Meg Ryan is ill. Nobody looks like that, okay, when they're ill.
She's
adorable. Yeah. She's got this little red nose. She's wearing matching pajamas. And I'm like, you know, even in this world where she's supposed to look schlubby, she is the best rom-com version of herself. And Tom Hanks, you know, at best looks like a businessman, or just like Tom Hanks, you know, at any given point in time. But the way he's written is I think what makes it count, you know, more so even than how somebody looks. Because I was also considering the fact that I think there are some stars who built a career on these sorts of films, and then we saw them struggle when they went out of style in many ways. But if you think about somebody who's often been considered, say, the most beautiful woman, someone like an Angelina Jolie or a Charlize Theron or something, they're not necessarily up there doing romantic films because they didn't kind of stake their claim on it. It's not something they wanted to do. And that inaccessibility continues to persist.
And I don't know that divide is as easily crossed for women as it sometimes seems to be for men. Because you could see a Brad Pitt sort of casually dropping in to do a romantic comedy here or there.
Or Meet Joe Black.
Meet Joe Black. Oh, talk about romances. I love
yes,
Meet Joe Black.
That is such a classic romance, 90s romance
yeah.
film.
Mm. But you couldn't, like, if you saw Meg Ryan trying to do what you'd call a more prestige film.
City
yeah.
of Angels.
Exactly. And then it flops, right? Because people don't really want to see her as a tragic heroine. Similarly, I don't think an Angelina Jolie or a Charlize Theron that you mentioned would find it as easy to do a romantic comedy because we've kind of boxed them into this inaccessible. So she could do a monster because, yeah, let's just put like horrible makeup on her.
Yep, yep, yep.
But not really a girl next door because we have very definite ideas of what those people look like.
But I think that might also be changing. I'm thinking here of something like Always Be My Maybe, which was so sharp and funny yeah. and really deeply enjoyable. And both the stars look pretty accessible. I don't know whether it's just because we live in Malaysia, so there are a lot of people who look like Ali Wong or Randall Park. But I thought that there was a certain accessibility to how they both looked, and there was no real attempt to make them look perfect. So maybe this is just a reflection of where we are right now.
Do you think it's because definitely, so to me, right, definitely maybe it was interesting because you watch it on a small screen.
Mm.
So I almost felt like it's sitcom world where people are allowed to look less
like they made for TV.
Yeah. So they look like real people because, well, with TV, people are more real than cinema.
Well, tell us what you think. I mean, we're talking today about romance in films and television. And we've been talking about our favorites. We've also been talking about our favorite romantic leads, or rather what makes a good romantic lead. Again, you can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. You can tweet us at BFM Radio. You can call 7733-2900 and write to us at movies@bfm.my.
Bodacious, fabulous minds. BFM 89.9, the business station.
I live in Notting Hill. You live in Beverly Hills. Everyone in the world knows who you are. My mother has trouble remembering my name.
The fame thing isn't really real, you know. And don't forget, I'm also just a girl standing in front of a boy, asking him to love her.
Hello, everyone. You are listening to Popcorn Culture with Lynn, Arvin, and Sharmila. And this week for obvious reasons, we are choosing to focus on romance in films. So we've been talking so far about how we define romantic films. We've been talking about what makes a good romantic lead. And now we come to the bread and butter stuff, the thing that has, in some ways, I think, kept this engine going for the last, I don't know, 20, 30 years. And that is the rom-com.
I thought you were going to say bread, butter and pizza because you can make a pizza with the amount of cheese in that clip.
It's oh, so, come on. It's
no,
messy.
Come on. Who does it?
It's okay. So cheesy.
I love that clip. Here I am like getting all like goosebumps and then you're like cheese.
It's so cheesy.
Isn't that... Okay. So I think let's use Arvin's cynicism as a way to kickstart the conversation, right? Because I think that comment rests at the very heart of rom-coms and romantic comedies and whether or not you enjoy them. So I am somebody who, in general, whether in music or in movies or in TV, I enjoy a certain amount of fromage. I'm quite happy with it. I expect it almost. I like it when it's well used. And I think with romantic comedies, I really appreciate one that takes its time, builds up its capital, and then delivers something like that. I'm just a girl. You know, it's deeply enjoyable. And I think someone like Richard Curtis, whom we've spoken about briefly before, does this extremely well. But so, Arvin, rom-coms, not for you?
It depends on how funny it is. So one of my, like, 27 Dresses is something that I could watch, like, at any given time.
So there you go. Now we're going to... I hate 27 Dresses. The only reason I'd watch it is James Marsden.
So I'm not saying it's a good movie, but it's one of those... It's good entertainment. It's good entertainment in the sense that if it was going on, I could hop in at any given moment and just continue the movie. I don't think it's a good story.
So you're more of the... romantic comedy through the Judd Apatow lens.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So I could watch like any number of those. Crazy Stupid Love is a good movie.
Stupid Love.
Yeah. So that's a good movie in my opinion. But the traditional rom-com, no, because again, this goes back to what we spoke about before. It's that the goal of each person happens to be the other. Like the guy wants to get the girl, or the girl wants to get the guy, and that completes their life cycle. Which I cannot. I just don't. I'm like, okay, it's fine. I understand. I empathize, but it's not for me.
Mm. See, for me, I always imagine that then they would end up like the old man in Up, that's where they're heading, and who wouldn't want to head there? I mean, look, I was raised on a steady diet of Disney, you know, princess movies, so I'm aware that this is no longer what I strive for, mostly. But there's something very sweet and almost innocent and fulfilling and non-cynical about the rom-com, the early rom-coms, not the ones where people have been beaten by love and now hate the world and have to be convinced out of their shells, but the Pretty Woman kind or the Sleepless in Seattle kind, where people meet nice people and you just haven't found each other, and then you do, and then there's this journey and something happens. And again, like Lynn said, they have to earn the right to use a line like that. I'm just a girl. But a lot of these movies do. And I think that those movies represent that kind of storytelling that doesn't get told anymore. The waiting and letting something happen, and then you allow it to get to you and sort of crawl inside your heart in a way that you wouldn't let something else.
So here's the thing, right? I think that a good romantic comedy has a certain amount of nastiness in it. So obviously it takes place in a really nice world where everybody works in a magazine or an architecture firm or, you know, is some sort of executive assistant and
or
is
florist.
Just florist, good one, baker also. So all sorts of, you know, about 10 professions left that you can choose from if you plan to be in a romantic comedy. And I get it. It's a very stylized world. But I think the best ones have a little bit of nastiness in its characters. You have to understand why they're annoying, because the truth is that very often the people you love are annoying. and so I think in order for a romantic comedy to work, the characters have to have that same slightly, what is this, you know, gritty quality. And I'm thinking here of Julia Roberts in My Best Friend's Wedding. She's nasty.
Oh, yes.
And you mentioned Pretty Woman. Richard Gere in Pretty Woman. Awful.
Yeah.
Bad person. Like, just generally all round not great. And that movie also has tons of other characters who are not Hector Elizondo, who are not the nice guy at the front desk willing to help out, you know, a girl on the street. So I think it's those things that make it interesting. And it's the loss of those sorts of characters and those sorts of storylines in, I would say, the noughties in the 2000s that made rom-coms die the way they did.
You're right. I think that one of the, you know, if we talk about what eventually caused the downfall of the rom-com is that it's forgetting that you're not just telling a sappy story, and it's not just about the laughs, that you need to populate this world with believable characters. And Pretty Woman is a great example, right? When you have that George Costanza, I was going to say Jason Alexander.
Exactly. I couldn't remember his name. I was like, George was terrible. Yeah.
So and that awful man at a party who makes her feel really bad about herself. You know, you need characters like that. And what happened to the romantic comedy was that it became so play by numbers that they started just filling in the gaps with the next big sitcom actress who wanted to make it on the big screen, you know, and who is the second tier actor who wants to kind of break into the next level. Let's cast them. And then we have a funny friend on each side and we're done. That's the story.
And I think you can see the divide between like the older rom-coms, like the ones who sort of established the genre, and the new ones that came out after that. The newer ones were populated by people like Gerard Butler, Jennifer Aniston. You had a lot of Adam Sandler,
Katherine Heigl
trying to do the same things over and over again, because the studios thought that it would make money, that it's a formula that works, and they'd always put it out during like Valentine's Day or maybe Christmas or somewhere around the holiday season to get people into the cinemas. But I think that's exactly it, because they kept doing the same stories again and again, and they couldn't justify to the audience like why they should care, because there was not enough, from their side, there was not enough effort or care put into the, you know, the scripts or the characters or to build up these people. And basically, I think that's, at the end of the day, people are like, yeah, I don't have to see this one movie because I've seen 12 others that were exactly like it.
Mm. And that sameness, that you know, sense of just turning everything into a generic machine churning things out, can be seen really clearly in someone like Adam Sandler, who I bring up in particular because I love The Wedding Singer. I really love that movie. And I recently rewatched 50 First Dates and still, you know, enjoyed that. And then I think of Murder Mystery, which is also about a couple rediscovering their spark. I mean, let's not pretend that it is in fact about a murder mystery. And you see that, yeah, that exact play-by-numbers quality. It's like, well, I know exactly what I can do. I'm just going to get me someone who also knows exactly what she can do, and then we'll just do that, which is a real pity and a waste when you have in your back catalogue something like Wedding Singer, which I think has that, again, that genuine mix of real sweetness and heart, but also nastiness. I mean, the guy's living in a basement, you know, his ex who left him is a real piece of work. That there are all these elements in that, and that's what makes the friction in the movie somewhat, if not believable, then at least something you can invest in.
Do you think if they made rom-coms into like a trilogy, it would work? Like if they made it into a franchise, because you franchise rom-coms and now people are like, ooh, I like rom-coms, but I also like franchise movies. Would they go see it? Like if it was packaged as one of those big franchise films, like Event Cinema.
Is this like Before Sunrise, Before Sunset?
Just thinking that is literally the only rom-com, not necessarily a com. But definitely a romantic trilogy that I can think of, otherwise being Twilight, which has the fantasy element to go for it. I don't know, you know. I think one of the joys of romantic movies in general, and definitely rom-coms, is that self-containedness, that you know that you're going to get the story in those 2 hours that you watch it. I don't know that it'll work, because then it'll become the equivalent of a sitcom and you'll have your Ross and Rachel, will they, won't they? And then, I don't know. I don't think that's something I'd sign up for.
So we've been talking about romance in films, focusing this time on the rom-com. If you sent us messages, sorry, I think we've gotten a little carried away and not managed to get to them, but please do keep in touch. We read them all. You can call us at 7733-2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899. And always, you can tweet us at BFM Radio.
Bruce Freddie Morrissey, BFM 89.9.
Tell me something, girl.
Do you write songs or anything?
I don't sing my own songs.
Why?
I just don't feel comfortable.
Why wouldn't you feel comfortable?
Almost every single person has told me they like the way I sounded, but that they didn't like the way I look.
I think you're beautiful.
I'm falling.
Hey.
What?
I just want to take another look at you.
In all the good times, I find myself longing.
Hello, everyone. You are listening to Popcorn Culture, and this is the final bit of our sort of romantic epic of a show, because we've been talking about romance in films. We've covered so far, let's see, How to Define It. We've covered leads, and we've talked about, of course, we had to, the rom-com. And now we come to modern romance and whether or not it's still a thing that we go to the cinemas to watch. So, of course, we just heard a little bit of A Star is Born, which was a Oscar-nominated, Oscar-winning in terms of the song, film that was also a remake of something from the 70s.
And the 30s.
And that got me thinking, actually, about how when you look at lists of romantic films, some of the things that come up tend to be stuff that I remember from my childhood. So I'm thinking here of Ghost, and you know, the hands and
the pottery
and all the rest of it. An Officer and a Gentleman, and you know, him like taking her and carrying her off, and how these movies had those big romantic finales.
Dirty Dancing. Patrick Swayze is romantic films for me.
But that's what I'm saying, right? And they all belong to a certain era, and we don't really do that as much anymore, or at least we don't seem to do it without an excuse. So if it's not set in space, if it's not, you know, if it's not set in World War II, you know, then it's not good enough to be seen on its own. But there was a time where people just did straight up, like hardcore cheese aisle love stories. And I don't know if that's something that we're not, that audiences don't want to pay for anymore.
So when I think of like modern love epics or love stories or love movies, I always think about La La Land, because it is, for me, it's like the perfect romantic film in the sense that it has everything you want from a romantic film, including an ending that a lot of people might not, may or may not agree on.
The ending got to me. I wept. The La La Land ending was just, yeah.
The ending makes the film, yes, though.
It does. Yeah. So also when you want to make a movie like that today, you have to pack it with so much stuff. Like, it has to have Ryan Gosling, and it has to have like Emma Stone, and then you have to go, people will be like, maybe I don't want to see this, then you go like, no, it's a musical, and then they're like, oh, maybe I still want to see it, oh no, but it's done by this person, and then they might go and watch it in the cinemas if it's like a big awards film. A Star is Born, and it's another one like Bradley Cooper, he directed it, and who's the other lead is Lady Gaga, and you have to pack it into it's a huge love story that's also, you know, again with the endings. Otherwise I don't see why people would go to the cinema to see these things anymore if they could just watch it at home.
I was wondering while both of you were talking, actually, whether really gender dynamics have changed so much that unless we find a way to tell these stories, because would those stories fly today? You know, baby in a camp falling in love with, you know, a much older man, or even the sweeping someone off their feet and carrying them. These are all things that are viewed as quite antiquated, right? And I don't necessarily want to play the whole like, oh, it's chauvinist card. There are definitely movies that do that. I don't think all of the movies do that. I'm actually fine with a lot of the tropes that used to be in those films as well. But I think that in the midst of trying to figure out what romance looks like in a woke world, we haven't yet figured out how to depict it on screen in a way that isn't wrapped in drama and music and dancing, and just real, unless it's then it becomes like a marriage story where then it's the problems.
That's exactly it. Yeah. So I was thinking that I think the other thing is people don't necessarily like watching happy stories or happy stories where nothing happened. That's not a story, right? Mm-hmm. Like all stories are based on conflict. There has to be some sort of journey, something happens. And when it comes to love stories, your options for something happening are not much. You know, something happens, your love is challenged. That tends to be the case. Your love is challenged and then something has to happen, which is why I think so many love stories that are told in a more prosaic way tend to focus on the breakup, or tend to focus on something bad happening
the
in
divorce.
That sense.
Mm.
Correct. Mm. And marriage story, I think, is a pretty interesting exploration of love and how love can change, and also of how love can in some ways be a cage. And it does so in a very, I would say, sensitive 2019, 2020 kind of way. But is it, you know, a love story in the classic sense? I'm not sure.
I mean, if it doesn't leave you feeling like you might want to be in love, I don't know if it is.
Mm. And also, we have become sort of like a community, or like a whole, you know, population of like chin scratchers nowadays, you know, in the sense that we don't watch movies and then keep quiet about it. Mm. And it's because of stuff like Twitter and social media, and video essay is a huge thing on YouTube. So we want to think about movies. What we're doing now is basically thinking about movies that we've watched. Right?
I was going to say we're a part of the problem, but yes.
Yeah. So
we kill the rom-com.
So you have a lot of people who go, what happens after the ending? Like, I want to know what happens next. Game of Thrones is a product of that. Like, Lord of the Rings had a happy ending, but what happens after? What about his tax policies? And no one asks these questions. No normal person asks these questions. But because there's such a huge number of people wanting to know, there is Game of Thrones.
Yeah, and yeah, you're right. All of those memes about, here's what the Disney princesses' lives are like after they got their princess. Which, I mean, it's funny, but you're right. I get it. I get why then that original trope gets parodied and broken down so much that there's little value in being straight-faced about revisiting it.
So maybe in a sense, I think romantic films do, for the time being at least, need the spectacle if you want people to go. Because I went to watch A Star is Born in the cinemas, and I did it knowing that it was going to be an old-fashioned experience. Meaning, I expected, I mean, if you're familiar with either of the previous iterations of A Star Is Born, it's a very specific trajectory. There's only one way for this to go. Mm. It's in the title. and so from the time that the, if you've seen it, when the title card comes up, it's a very old-fashioned way to do it. Yep. It's a girl walking down a street mm-hmm. and then A Star Is Born comes up. And in every way, it is an old-fashioned movie. And I really enjoyed it. But at the same time, I enjoyed it knowing that I really don't pay to go to the cinema very often for this. And I did this time because I wanted to be a part of a zeitgeisty thing because it looked like an interesting film. And so I think if a romance film doesn't capture that sense of either spectacle or zeitgeist in some way, if it doesn't get memeified, if it doesn't get, you know, hyped, I think it's difficult to convince people to go.
I think that another thing that could work, at least it's worked for me, is when that romance is placed within a landscape that you recognize is difficult or and I'm thinking here of movies like, because when I was thinking about the movies that I think of as love stories that I really connected with and made me cry or feel, in the last 10-15 years, the three that actually came to mind are Brokeback Mountain, Moonlight, and Call Me By Your Name. And you can look at the, mm-hmm. the connections between those three movies. And I think it's that idea that within that kind of political, social context, given that you understand the challenges that the characters are going through, I feel like you're a lot more willing to suspend your, like, oh, but then what happens after they get the person they love? Yeah. You know, you're more like, oh, wow, I understand why love can be grand and painful and difficult, and yet you want it so much.
But also fluid. So that's another thing. Like when you look at all three movies that you named, including stuff like TV shows that we watched, like Sex Education and End of the Bleeping World, they all have like a core that has relationships and romance in them, but they have fluid relationships. Like it opens up options. It opens up the nuance of being in a relationship. It opens up like what people understand about relationships and how they approach it. Different ages, different brackets, people of different color. So when you cannot put that into a movie anymore. When you make like a straightforward guy, girl, fall in love, this is the situation, and they you know, that has to be the end of the movie. People don't buy into that. Because I'm thinking about, let's say something from the 90s came on today, would it work? Like, would we talk about it the same way or love it the same way? I don't think we would. We would dissect it and go, it's way too simplistic. Like, they didn't put much thought into it.
I don't think Prostitute with a Heart of Gold living on Beverly Hills is a pitch that anybody would hear now and go like, yeah, heck yeah. Although I do also just want to chime in with both Moonlight and Call Me By Your Name in particular, there is a tonal thing to those movies where there is a certain mood and poetry that those particular films capture, a lot to do with silences and visuals and how they use them and sort of, they're almost meditative films. Mm-hmm. I mean, they are about love and masculinity, but they also kind of just sit with those ideas for a long time. Not a lot happens. And I love them for that reason. I totally get it. Moonlight, I just cried and cried. But they are art house films, right?
Yes,
I mean, they kind of occupy that specific realm. The movie that I was thinking of, counteracting my own point earlier about, oh, it has to be set in space, that really made me feel a lot, aside from Moonlight, was Shape of Water by Guillermo del Toro, which is, I mean, you could read it as a fairy tale. You could read it as a story about monsters and about the Cold War, or you could read it, as I did, as a straight up love story, and a love story between people is a loose term here, between beings
humanoids
who have to also, who communicate in a way outside of language, you know, and that was the stuff that really got to me. The fact that I was watching these two outsiders fall in love across many, many boundaries. And I love that film. And I would thoroughly put it up there as a film that is about love. But I don't think people necessarily associate it immediately with romance.
I honestly think that Guillermo del Toro would have wanted to make a love story, like a straight up love story fairy tale, but he had to change it to have weird looking creatures in it just to sell. I mean, that is, you know, you have to put like a fish looking thing on a poster underwater with a woman and people get curious. They're like, oh, maybe I should watch this in the cinema because it has these sci-fi elements to it. If it was just a man and a woman, people would have gone, why? Like, you know, what is the point?
What is a Guillermo? No, I don't know. I don't know that I agree with that, because Guillermo del Toro does love his monsters, love his Doug Jones. So I do think that, you know, that's kind
of... That's a love story.
That is in and of itself. But yeah, any movies for you in the last 10 or so years that have really stood out as a romantic film?
La La Land, for sure, as mentioned. I think Marriage Story, I think, is also a romantic film, even though it's slightly, you know, tragic and stuff. Last 10 years, not a lot. Like, I can't think of any within the last 10 years. Maybe from the early 2000s, Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist is one movie that I really like. I also think Her has a lot to say about relationships.
Oh, I love Her. Yeah. If I had to pick in the last 10 years, I think I would pick Her.
So that's the thing, again, with the fluidity and the nuance and the different relationships and stuff. But Her is one of my favorite romantic films, even though it's like super messed up.
You know, I was in a screening the other day and the screen wasn't on because why? But while that was happening, Scarlett Johansson started speaking. Now, not as Her, but as Black Widow. But there's something about her voice and there's something about the way she performed in Her that I heard it and my heart clenched a little bit because I was like, you're going to run off with a bunch of AI. Spoilers for Her. I'm sorry. If you haven't seen it, then yeah.
But why haven't you seen it? It's an amazing film.
Mm.
Yeah. If recommendations are what you're looking for in the show, modern romance, nothing defines modern romance better than Her.
On that note, tell us what your favorite romantic films are. Tell us if you have films that I suppose you consider romantic that don't necessarily fall within the narrow scope of what people would traditionally consider a romantic drama or a romantic comedy. You can call us at 7733-2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899. And of course, tweet us at BFM Radio. If you want updates on shows coming up next week or just to chat with us, you can do so by following BFM Popcorn on Twitter and Instagram. You're listening to Popcorn Culture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.